For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back. Hope you all enjoyed your yontif. Nice to take that break. Well, we're very excited to introduce Rabbi Daniel Freitag, Dunwoody, and Riel, Atlanta Scholars, Kol Hall of Fame. Rabbi Freitag has actually been running a class very similar to the one that we've been doing here for a number of years in Ariel, and is actually the source of much of the material that we have from our curriculum we've been using from the Morashah Institute. Rabbi Freitag was actually involved in developing that curriculum. So it is a special treat to have Rabbi Freitag here. Thank you very much for being here. And he has chosen to speak about Kabbalah and mysticism, which is one of his favorite topics, I understand, as are most of the topics on our curriculum. So without any further ado, I'm very excited to introduce Rabbi Freitag. Thank you for
all
being
right,
here.
All right, howdy, y'all. First of all, hello, I'm glad to be here, and I came all the way from Dunwoody, a long schlep, oh boy, oh boy. So tonight's class is about mysticism and Kabbalah in Judaism. Before I begin, I do want to say that I am an interactive speaker. I don't like to talk at you, I like to speak with you, so I encourage interruptions and hand-raising. What's that?
I said you came to the right place.
I came to the right place, excellent, fantastic. Wow. All right, now, when Rabbi Freundlich asked me to speak on this topic, I told him I don't mind speaking about it as long as I don't get put in cherem, or banned, or excommunicated. He said that you're not likely to do that. But more specifically, I'm actually not going to be teaching Kabbalah. I'm going to be speaking about it, obviously. I'm not a Kabbalist, and we're not going to be teaching Kabbalah. But we're going to talk a little bit about what mysticism is in Judaism, and what Kabbalah is, and some of the basic concepts and ideas that we have in Judaism. And again, I encourage questions, because when I got this topic, I wasn't sure exactly what people wanted to hear. Did you want to hear more of the themes and ideas in Kabbalah? Did you want to hear the history of the personalities? What did you want? So I put a little bit of both, but we'll focus on a little bit of whatever we can. Now, the first thing I want to point out, the word mysticism is an interesting word, and I'm not sure what we mean by it when we talk about it in the context of Judaism. You know, if I would ask you in terms of American culture, if someone is a mystic, right, I say, well, they what would they do? Maybe they sit on a mountaintop and do like meditation. Like, what makes someone a mystic? What's mystical in the first place? What does the word mean? Right? So in a sense, when you use the word mystic or mystical, it seems like you're talking about something relating to other dimensions and other worlds, and something beyond the physical. Well, in Judaism, mysticism is a fundamental part of the whole system. You can't have mysticism in Judaism and Judaism without mysticism. There are fundamental aspects of Judaism that are mystical. Judaism does not function in any way, for example, if you don't have a soul. If you don't have an afterlife, if you don't have prophecy, God speaking to the Jews. I mean, I don't know. We sat down. The kids asked us, you know, why do we eat matzah tonight? And our answer was that there was this power, divine power that did miracles before our eyes. Sounds kind of mystical, I suppose, right? This whole religion is fundamentally a mystical religion. It talks about these fundamental ideas. You can't really even learn Chumash with Rashi without encountering angels, the afterlife. You're going to encounter all that stuff as a basic fundamental background to Judaism. So it's not like mysticism is this unique personality within Judaism. It's part of it. There's no other way to look at the religion. Sure, you can go to the rabbi and ask him, what time do I burn the chametz? What time do I eat the chametz? It's so much fun to talk about chametz when you can eat it, right? You can go nosh on it right now, right? But that's practical brass tacks Judaism. But in the end, the religion is fundamentally based on, rabbi, why don't we eat chametz? Oh, because God commanded us. Really? How did he do that? He spoke to Moses through prophecy. Oh, really? Is that true? And he did these miracles. Oh, there's a whole lot of mysticism showing up for the reason why I had to crunch on that matzah. Right? So let's start with that fact. Mysticism is not some other dimension in Judaism. It's fundamentally part of it. You can't separate it. It's basic to the whole religion. In fact, I have here a list of some of the essential concepts, which we can run through a little bit. It sounded like maybe people wanted to talk a little bit more about the history and the personalities and some of the practical modern-day aspects. Practical Kabbalah. No, we're not going to do any dibuks tonight. Let's just look at it. For example, right here, I have a list of basic mystical teachings in Judaism. So number one, A, the soul, right? There's no such thing as Judaism without a person having a soul. What is a soul?
Neshama.
What's good? A neshama, great. And what's a neshama? A soul. That's right. Okay, what do we do? What is it?
A spark of the divine.
That's a nice, yeah, yeah. A purposeful being. That's not, I like that. It's not bad. This could be the same thing, right? We're describing the same thing, yeah.
The non-physical part of a person.
Right. So there's the physical and there's something else, right? Spiritual. So that's what a soul is. So what? So you have a soul. So what? Let's say you found out. Okay, I have a soul. What do I do about that? What does it do to you? How does your soul affect you?
It guides you.
Depends who you are. Some people, you know, what guides them is something else, you know. Maybe they like beer a lot, and that's what guides them, you know. Maybe they like sports, and that's what guides them. When you say what guides you, you have to be careful what you say, right? Because someone will say, well, my soul really likes to eat, you know. So, what's that?
It's our purpose here, to conquer the physical and let that soul take over.
So there's something inside of us that we hopefully can perceive that pushes us in some way to connect to something beyond the physical, right? And that we call our soul. And what when you say it's not part... Yes?
In theory, it precedes the physical and lives beyond the physical entity.
Correct.
In which case, it's an awful lot like God.
Oh, we got to be very careful. So you say, it's the last... Everything was great, and then you said the last line, you said it's an awful lot like God. Okay. So we don't... I want to clarify something that's interesting because Kabbalah does get into that issue of addressing the Jewish concept of what God is. And so, if I had to ask you a basic question, is God physical or spiritual? What's the answer? The answer is neither. Neither. There is no category that God belongs in that we know of. Right? We have a physical universe and we have a spiritual universe in which there's soul and angels. God is not limited to that realm. God is not limited to any realm. God doesn't belong in any realm. In fact, one of the phrases we use to refer to God is Hamakom. Hamakom. Hamakom Yerachem. Right. So what does Hamakom mean? How do you translate that? The place. We call God the place. It's like a really interesting nickname, right? It's like, I'm going to talk to the place. What is that? And the Talmud explains that Hamakom means He's not here. We are inside of Him. The world is... He's the place where the world is. The world is not the place where He is. Right? Okay, we're getting a little Kabbalistic already, a little early in the class. Right? But the point is that we have no descriptors for God. So the soul is a part of the spiritual realm. It's true. And you were saying before that, that it lives on past the physical, and it exists before the physical, and in fact, maybe before and after don't really apply to things to which time doesn't apply at all. And maybe the spiritual realm doesn't have time. Yes.
So in the word neshama, Hashem, name. So each of us carries a name, Hashem. So some connection, our name, to his.
Right. There is some discussion.
Kind of part of the eternity, some right. aspect of us that fits into that tapestry.
Yeah, there is some discussion that the neshama. There are phrases that people throw around, which I've heard before, a spark of the divine, which is from a legitimate source, but we have to be careful what that means, because obviously there's not a piece of God inside of me. It's not like I'm a little bit God. A little bit, sometimes, depends with who. You know, I'm not a little bit God. None of us are, right? The truth is, for those of you who know me in my classes, I do an hour class on every one of these topics here, and we're not going to do that tonight. But just getting started. So if the soul, so what about an afterlife? Now, what's the most interesting thing about an afterlife is that you encounter many people who talk about Judaism's view of the afterlife. So some people say, oh, I love being Jewish because we don't believe in an afterlife. Have you ever met people who say that? You've never heard that. I've heard people say, yeah, Judaism is great, doesn't believe in an afterlife, which is shocking. It's unbelievable. It's everywhere. How could you think that? It's like Judaism doesn't have Pesach. What? It's everywhere. It's so fundamental that Maimonides, who lists some of the 13 essential beliefs of Judaism, one of his fundamental beliefs is a belief in the resurrection of the dead. Sounds like an afterlife to me, right? He says if you don't believe that, you basically don't believe what Judaism believes, right? What's more is I was so curious about where this idea came from, that people thought Judaism doesn't believe in an afterlife. So, you know, among my wife's many wonderful traits, this is down at like number 4,000, is that she comes from a family that produces Jewish software. So, the Dafka software in Chicago. So, I sometimes get free software. Right. So I got one that I can search many Jewish texts at once. So I thought, okay, let's just see how many times certain concepts in the afterlife are mentioned, you know, in these texts. So I limited my search to the Talmudic texts, Talmud, Medrash, that era, and I limited to the word Gehenna. That's only one type of afterlife word. And I think it showed up 1,250 times. It's not that obscure. It's not like something like, whoa! I mean, we would have known there's such a thing as an afterlife. We sort of missed it. You can't learn Rashi without encountering the afterlife in Judaism. It's a fundamental concept in Judaism, the idea that there's reward and punishment, that our soul lives on. I don't know how you read the Rosh Hashanah Machzor without seeing that, right? So there's so much there, there's so much you could see in Judaism that's fundamental to the belief that there's an afterlife, that we, when we die, we pass on, and our soul goes on, and there's a place where there is judgment, right? In fact, you know, people say, well, okay, maybe we believe in an afterlife. We don't believe in hell. You heard that one? That at least you heard. I mean, everyone. Judaism doesn't believe in hell. By the way, do we believe in hell? What's that? Raise your hand if you think we believe in hell. What's that? Kind of. Well, so right. So again, the theory, I always wondered, where does the idea come from that people think Judaism doesn't believe in this? And I think the answer is, first of all, when we say when people say that we don't believe in hell, well, we believe in Gehenna. It's kind of the same thing. It's a little different. I mean, what the Christian idea of hell is eternal fire. Okay, so that we don't believe in. We don't believe in eternal punishment. We're nicer, right? It's not good, but it doesn't last as long, right? I suspect this came from a reaction to Christianity. It's my own theory. I have no idea. That was odd. It's my own theory. I don't know. But perhaps because Christianity focused so much on saying to people, their whole pitch was, believe in this or go to hell forever. So maybe Judaism was like, we don't believe in that. What don't you believe in? You know, the hell forever? Okay, that we don't believe in too. But the idea that a person is responsible for their actions and is punished after they die for their wrong behavior, it's a fundamental concept in Judaism, right? Are we mystical yet? I don't know. Are we mystical? When someone dies, we do a funeral, we say Kaddish. What are we saying Kaddish for? For a soul. Are we mystical? You could be the most unmystical person in Judaism and go say Kaddish and go to Yisker. Are you mystical yet? These are fundamental ideas in Judaism. Moving on. Are there any questions about the afterlife? Of course there are. It's like, yeah, yes. That's a lot of information. The question as to what the specific stages of the afterlife are is a matter of a little bit of some debate of what the stages are. The best book that I would recommend for any Jewish mysticism and the fundamental idea of the afterlife is Derech Hashem by the Ramchal, called The Way of God. You can get it in English. And I call it a book, even though it's a sefer. It's not a book you like sit on the couch and read on Shabbos afternoon, unless you know you ate the chant, you're going to fall asleep after one line. You have to sit down and study it. But it is readable. It's done very well. And it will lay out for you exactly the stages and all the different places where the soul goes and what it needs to accomplish. Again, it's best done in a class setting or with a commentary because it's something you study. But it's an excellent book. It's a fantastic book. And we'll talk about the Ramchal a little bit later. So, what's that? The Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. Luzzatto, yeah. Well, I think I have him. Do I have him down here? Well, I'm going to put him down at the bottom because it's important. All right, the Messianic Age. Right? Messianic Age. This is another fundamental idea. We believe that Jewish history is leading to a particular point where the Messiah is going to come and do what? What's that? Rebuild the temple. What else? Fantastic. That's the easiest one. Usher the Messianic era. That covers everything. The Messiah's going to come. He's going to show up. He's going to bring us the Messianic age, which is kind of mystical. We're all going to move back to the land of Israel. There's going to be peace on earth.
Isn't that the resurrection of the dead?
Maybe. Probably not. Most opinions say that the resurrection is later, after the Messianic age starts. I mean, there's the Messiah, but again, there's some debate as to the timeline, right? So, it's a pretty mystical thing. Some force is going to come, going to redeem all the Jews, gather them all from all over the world, bring them to Israel, and build a temple where there's that dome over there. And there still won't be a war. That's pretty good, right? I mean, pull that off, and we know you're the Messiah. It's really funny because sometimes the Christians say, well, if you don't believe our proof texts, how do you know who the Messiah is? And so I'm building a temple over there and brings peace on earth. I guess I'll know. It's pretty easy. Like that. How do you identify who it is? The person who does that's the Messiah. It's pretty practical, right? All right. So this is what we believe. This is a fun. And again, this is one of the 13 essential beliefs of Judaism, according to the Rambam. Belief in the coming of the Messiah, the Messianic age. That our people have a mission, a long-term mission, besides their own personal mission. Our people have a mission that ends up with the Messianic age. The resurrection of the dead. Again, one of the beliefs that Maimonides counts as an essential belief. If you don't believe the resurrection of the dead, you're not believing in the same religion. It's unbelievable, right? That the dead will come back to life. What does that mean? In what context? This world, the world to come. All right, that's a longer discussion. But again, fundamental to our religion. Prophecy and revelation, that God communicates to human beings. You think that's pretty important? Right? I mean, without it, we don't have a religion, right? That Moshe spoke to God, got all the information, that there were prophets later that clarified it. Again, standard stuff. The angels, Yetzer Hara, Satan. Again, each one of these is an hour class, but you see in the Torah itself, it talks about angels coming to Abraham, right? We have many examples of this. Now, G really doesn't belong in this list. G is Tzimtzum and Sephiroth. What is this and why is it in this list? I put it in the list because I didn't know where else to put it. But let me explain what's going on. Up until now, we've been talking about things which are so fundamental to Judaism, you learn about them in elementary school. In just a basic day school, you will learn about these concepts because Judaism as a system does not function without them. If you take these things out of Judaism, you've gutted the religion, there's nothing left except a bunch of rituals. There's nothing left, right? The fundamental idea that God communicated to humans and said to them, you have a body and you have a soul, and as a result, you have to do the following actions that I command you so that it'll be good for your soul, your spiritual things, in the afterlife, etc. That's our system. Tzimtzum and Sephiroth is a little different. Now, you may have heard of some of this stuff, and this is really when you start getting into what people usually refer to when they start talking about the word Kabbalah. Right? Now, the word Kabbalah, the Hebrew word, what does it mean?
The received
knowledge, right? The knowledge that's been passed down. Now, the truth is, Kabbalah is not the only knowledge that's been passed down in Judaism. We have an entire body of our Torah called Torah Shebaal Peh, the Torah that's been passed down. This is a little different because it's implied that it's been passed down by selective individuals to selective individuals. It wasn't open to the public, right? And what was it? What was this knowledge and what was it talking about? I mean, I guess the best word to say is esoteric knowledge. But let's take an example. Now, I want to clarify that I am not a Kabbalist. Right? Nobody you know is a Kabbalist. Right? And what this means is just, we know the ideas and what's being talked about, but none of us are really delving in it to the true depth. What does Tzimtzum mean? Well, let's start with what the problem is. The problem you're dealing with is you're trying to ask the following question. We believe there's a God, and that God is one. You ever heard of that? What does it mean that God is one? Shema Yisrael. What does that mean?
He's the source of it.
The source of, Some people think, well, it means there's one God, but actually it means something more than that. It means that God is one. That means God has no parts and never changes. What does that mean? It's hard to understand. In fact, there's a book, Chovos Halavavos, which is a book, it's a standard Musar text, and it talks about, there's a whole chapter on this, on understanding the concept that God is one, and all of the commentaries on Chovas HaLevavos skip that chapter, like, listen, this is beyond me, this is heavy stuff. Okay, God is one. Are we inside God? Right now, where are we? Does this exist or does this not exist? My watch. Does this exist? So is God, is this watch God? I understand. So is this physical location where this watch is?
No.
So is God not here where the watch is?
Yes.
So there's a place where God is not? So God is everywhere, but is one. But then there's things that are also here.
Within the
do they exist? Do these things that exist, are they separate from God or are they part of God? They're part of God? This piece of wood is part of God? Is my thumb part of God? That's impressive. I mean, it's pretty good. Right? Am I part of God? Is my hair part of God? Do you hear the question that's being dealt with here? The problem with asking these questions is that as Jews, we've always said, we don't understand what God is. If you remember the story in the Torah, Moshe goes to God and says, show me your face. Right? And what does God say to him? He says, no person can see my face and live. What does it mean, a face? God doesn't have a face. What it seems to be saying is Moshe wants to understand the fundamental essence of God. He wants to, like you see a person, you see their face. Oh, I know you now. Right? Not I've heard of you. You know, I've heard stories about you. I've met you. So Moshe wants to know what God is, and God says you can't. It's not physically possible for a human being to understand what God is. But God does give us some information. He tells us that there's one, that God is one. So then we're stuck with these questions. Like where? I don't understand. If God is one and God is everywhere, then how can things exist? And beyond that, how can things exist? How can I physically act in a way that God does not want? Right? How is that possible? If God is the programmer of my programming, how can I literally just do something God doesn't want me to do? How's that even possible? I guess it's part of the program, but that means God is helping me as I move my hand to do the thing that God said not to do, right?
He gave us free will.
Right, so that's God moving my hand right there. Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. The whole system doesn't work without free choice. But the point is that within, going back to the previous thing, the idea that these things exist, and God also exists in the same place, and are they? They're not part of God. What's going on? So the concept here, which addresses the same issue of action, the Kabbalists talk about something called tzimtzum. What is it? I can describe it to you in the most layman's terms because I don't understand it. Tzimtzum is a word which describes that God allows a space, so to speak. He created sort of a space, an area to create creation. Because how could physical objects exist if everything is God? God is everything and everything is one, so then individual separate objects can't exist. So there's something called tzimtzum. So to a layman it sounds like what God did is he made a little bit of a vacuum inside of himself. Well, that can't be. God didn't make a vacuum where there's no God. So the Kabbalists discuss what the concept means. How did it happen? How can this world exist? How can it's just, and in a sense, this concept that we call the Sefirot is similar, kind of. Some of you may have seen those diagrams with the circles and the lines, right? And the different names of the different circles and the lines go to different things. I don't know much about it. Most people you know don't know much about it. Most people who claim to know things about it don't know much about it, right? But on a basic level, what it seems to be describing, according to some opinions, is what we're trying to understand is the flow of interaction between God and this world. This interaction, for example, you may have noticed. It's great that we're doing this after Pesach. There's so many Pesach metaphors. You read your Haggadah. So, unless that was the part where everyone was like a little tired and Uncle Joe was reading really fast, you remember the part where you said, Ani v'lo malach. That's my tune. That's how we sing it. I don't know how you sing it. Ani v'lo saraf. What does that mean? don't know if you read the English part in the... I took you out of Egypt. I, God, not an angel. I, not a flaming angel, but me, myself, personally. Remember that part? You remember that? Are there things that God doesn't do but happen in this world? What do you mean by that? What, are there things that God doesn't do and the things that he does do? What was he saying? He's like, that I did myself. So if you say that, I understand. It's you, not that other guy. What did God mean here? I did that, not an angel. What, was an angel got free will? It can do whatever it wants? No. Are there things that happen that angels do that God is not behind that? What's the difference? This is already, it was Kabbalah in your Haggadah over there. Right? So what we're dealing with here is a question of a God. God is powerful, right? God, you can't see God or else you would die. So how can this physical world exist without bursting into complete non-existence if it had to contact God? It's like you take your vacuum cleaner and it's not working. You got a blackout. So you go to the local power station where they have a nuclear power station. You say, excuse me, I'm just going to plug in my vacuum. Right? What happens when you plug in the vacuum? You can't plug in your vacuum to the reactor. Right? So in a sense, Sefirot, according to some, is the description of the filters between God's direct access and us at the bottom. It's the most simplistic way to describe it. Very simplistic, layman's terms, not very complicated, not very sophisticated. And in some way describing what that means. I guess on Pesach night, God said, no more filters, I'm showing up. How that worked, I don't know. Right? By the way, many people say that the meaning of that is that some things that happen in this world indirectly, they don't have to be permanent. But anything that God comes and shows up and does himself, the effect that it has is that it's permanent. And when God took the Jews out of Egypt personally, well, they'll be Jews forever. Right? God made the Jewish people, we're eternal. That's why we're still here. So the idea seems to be that God interacts generally with the world. Of course, God oversees everything. But maybe through filters and interactions, and that's how this world can continue to function on a very base physical level. Okay. These are Kabbalistic concepts. I don't study Kabbalah. Most of us don't study Kabbalah. But these are some of the initial ideas that Kabbalah was discussing, addressing. Now, you may have heard that you're not supposed to study Kabbalah till you're 40. You ever heard that one? Yeah, ever heard that? So there's an old idea that a person's not supposed to study Kabbalah till they're 40. This does not mean that on someone's 40th birthday they have a happy Kabbalah day. It's like when you were 21, you went out for a drink, and now you're 40, here's your Kabbalah book. It's not how it works. Let me give you a little bit of background to this, and we're going to tie it in to some modern history and things that are going on. So in the year about, sometime in the 1600s, this is under B, the Shabtai Tzvi. We're going to skip around a little bit on my page here. There was a man named Shabtai Tzvi. Many of you may have heard of him. Famous fellow. Hung around mostly in Turkey. And what he did was, is he declared that he was the Messiah. Okay? Looking at the historical descriptions of him as a person, it turns out that he was bipolar. It's pretty clear. I mean, it'll say, you know, in people who translate the writings of the descriptions of him, you know, the older descriptions will say, he fell many days into melancholy, but then shortly after sprung up from his melancholy and was ever so forceful and did not sleep for even 2 hours. It's like, oh, wow, okay. And said he was the Messiah. Okay, we have a diagnosis for that nowadays, but they didn't then. So he declared that he was the Messiah. He declared he was the Mashiach. And word starts getting out. Now, if you want to declare that you're the Mashiach, what are you going to do? Can't just be a regular fella walking down the street telling people you're the Mashiach and putting up billboards, vote for me. You know, shaking hands, kissing babies. It doesn't work that way. You got to be a little different. People expect something dramatic, right? So one of the things that he did is he engaged Kabbalistic teachings, which he most likely didn't understand, but also no one else did. So he'd pull verses out of Kabbalistic texts, misinterpret them, which is pretty easy to do if no one knows what it is, no one knows what it means. And by that way, would act in strange ways. He'd marry a Sefer Torah. He got married to a Sefer Torah. He ate some non-kosher and made a blessing, Baruch Matir Isurim, which means, you know, blessed are you God who permits the forbidden. Like, all right. I mean, I guess you'd expect a mystical Messiah to do things like that. You wouldn't just expect them to be sitting there studying Gemara and stuff, right? It's got to be the Messiah, right? The problem is that over time, his crusade gained a lot of followers throughout Europe. To the extent that you think, all right, big deal. So what's the downside of that? So people think the Mashiach's coming. Well, I mean, if you're living in Europe in the 1600s and you think the Mashiach's coming, first of all, you're desperate for the Mashiach to come after what you've been going through, you know, for hundreds of years. And people, you know, once you think the Mashiach's coming, so you go to your neighbor who's been bugging you for years and you say, you thumb your nose at him. You say, yeah, you've been nasty to us Jews. You're going to get it in 2 weeks, baby. You're going to really get it. Right? And people would sell all their businesses and needle their non-Jewish neighbors who were nasty to them and, you know, and get ready to go. Okay. Now that could be a problem if the guy turns out not to be the Messiah. So, over time, you know, various rabbis in Europe sent emissaries to check him out. Like, what's the deal? They're hearing rumors. Everything's secondhand. Eventually, the local sultan in Turkey hears, you know, about this guy who's claiming that he's the king of the world or something. And the sultan doesn't like that very much. So he calls in Shabbosai Tzvi and he says to him, I got an idea for you. Either you convert to Islam now or I kill you now. And Shabbosai Tzvi said, Islam sounds nice. And he converted on the spot. That can put a little kink in things for your messianic campaign. Right? By the way, it may shock you to know that for many of his followers, that actually didn't end it. There were many people, well, I mean, I don't know what percentage of the people who initially believed him, there were many people locally who still, in that area where he lived, who still believed in him. It's the final test. This is the final test. He's done a lot of weird stuff. This is also weird. You know, it's just another weird thing that he did. He converted to Islam. Okay. Right? So, there were still people, for many hundreds of years actually, had like dwindling numbers of individuals who still kind of believed, you know, he was the Mashiach. And when you give people a lot of hope, they're really desperate. But for most people who are rational, it was a devastating experience. They lost their businesses, they were pogroms, it was a horrible situation. And what was worse was the rabbis realized that what he had done is he'd used Kabbalistic teachings and verses and just tossed them around, people without any understanding, and used it to sort of get a lot of power. So at that point, the rabbis recognized and understood that you can't really understand Kabbalah without having spent at least 40 years of your life in intense Torah study. It's not a birthday issue. It's having studied Torah for at least that long. It's kind of like if your 7-year-old comes in and says, hey, Dad, I'm trying to figure out this whole leptons and protons quantum mechanics thing. Can you explain it to me before we get into the whole arithmetic stuff? Right? And you say, well, I can tell you words. They're not going to mean anything to you. And what's even more is that a fellow like me who loves this stuff, I have to be honest and recognize that when I read a book about quantum mechanics, I still love this stuff. I can't give a lecture on it, you know, in a level of physics because I've never studied it in depth. There's some things you can't honestly say you understand until you spent the time understanding the fundamental basics of it. And Kabbalah is one of those things. You have to know Chumash. You have to know Rashi. See, it sounds boring. Everyone wants to dive right into Kabbalah. When I'm like, oh, I really want to just crack open that Kabbalah book and just dive right in. Okay, well, okay, let's start with, okay, Abraham took his son Isaac. Like, oh, wow, come on. That's you can't even open a Kabbalah book without that stuff. Right? There's nothing to talk about. You have to know all about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the relationships of these things. Just even ask yourself a basic question. You've heard of them. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, Leah. You've heard of them, right? The founders of the Jewish people. Did you ever stop and ask yourself, gee, why did the founding of the Jewish people take 3 generations? What was it with? Why did you have to have 3? I mean, we all know this since we're kids. Well, why did it take 3 generations? Why don't we just start it with an individual and his wife, and then all the kids are Jewish and have a nice day. Why do we have to go through 3 iterations? Abraham, and then it's Isaac, and Ishmael, and then you know, all the way till you get to Jacob, and then, oh, finally, all his kids are Jewish. I'm not talking Kabbalah yet. It's just knowing basic stuff doesn't allow someone to understand Kabbalah. You need to study, and you got to all know all the laws. And I'm not talking about myself, because I don't know it. That's why I'm not a Kabbalist, right? But there's a lot to know. So when we talk about 40 years, they said, listen, don't even open the book or make believe you know what you're doing until you've studied for 40 years straight. Then you can start talking. All right? The idea was to minimize the ability of people to use mystical teachings to mislead Jewish people. Now, that ban, that thing, lasted, you know, theoretically until this time. It's not a ban, so to speak. It was just sort of a recommendation, right? Interestingly, about 100 years later or so, there was a great sage named Rabbi Yonason Eibeschitz, who was considered one of the greatest sages of his time. And at the very same time, there was another man named Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who suspected Rabbi Eibeschitz of being a secret admirer and follower of Shabtai Tzvi. And this may not sound that interesting to all y'all, like, who are these two random personalities? But it ended up being a huge clash. Rabbi Yaakov Emden used to try to prove, hey, he's still following that crazy Messiah. And Rabbi Eibeschitz would say, that's silly. And as we'll see a little soon, this had an effect on a later event. Now, you see under B, Hasidic movement. Now, what does that have to do with anything? What it has to do with is like this. Let's give a little background to the Hasidic movement and sort of move into today a little bit. How many of y'all have met a Hasid? Met some, met any Hasidic folks? All right, very good. What's that?
In Ariel.
In Ariel, okay, very good. In Atlanta. Okay. So the Hasidic movement is interesting because it's a movement whose origins you can trace. It started around the late 1700s by a man named the Baal Shem Tov. And, well, what is it? What did he do? Well, here's what's going on. You're living in Europe, and life is rough. You may have heard that, right? You're living as a potato farmer or whatever it is. And you're having a hard time connecting to Judaism spiritually. Why? Well, fundamentally, one of the primary ways that you interact with Judaism is Torah study. Torah study. Learning Torah. Understanding Torah. Right? Well, what if you'd never had time to get past third grade? What if you're stuck in the fields and you don't have time more than 5 minutes a day to breathe? What if you're a Poshut Yid, a simple Jew, just trying to make your way? You can barely read the books, or you feel disconnected. Sure, there are great sages around, but maybe you're not one of them, right? So a lot of Jews felt very disconnected. They kind of felt religion was kind of like dry and intellectualist. You know, yeah, you do some rituals. So the Baal Shem Tov felt that was a problem. So he came up with a system. He's going to get Jews engaged, excited, interested, spiritual even. He goes to the various towns. He says, here's what we're going to do. We're going to set up chavuras. I don't know what he called it back then. Groups. We get someone in town agrees to be the rabbi, the Rebbe, right? The grand rabbi of your group. And the way you simple Jews connect to Judaism, instead of focusing on all the intellectualism, which is fine as a part of Judaism, you're going to focus on connecting to this rabbi and his holiness. You'll sit at his table and you'll sing songs together and you'll eat his Shabbat leftovers. You think I'm joking, right? No, they call that Shirayim, right? His sparks of holiness that he puts into his Shabbat food, if you eat a little bit of that, you help raise those holy sparks as well, and you're sort of working together with him. And if you sit around and sing those holy songs, and maybe have a L'chaim or two, right? You get raised up spiritually. And for many people, that worked. If you're a simple Jew plowing the fields all week, and then you go to a tish, you go to the rabbi's table Friday night, and you hear some words of Torah, and you feel you're singing, and there's like a... It's more, you know, it's more engaging for the average Jew than opening up a book that you can't read. So it was, to a large degree, very successful with many people, right? One of the aspects that he introduced was Kabbalistic teachings. Because part of that whole idea of there's holy sparks everywhere, and you release the holy sparks, and people were able to connect to a feeling. It was more of an emotional style of Judaism that connected you in symbolic ritual ways instead of just learning about when I eat my chametz and when I don't. Now, as you can imagine, that was slightly controversial because there's that whole ban thing about not engaging in Kabbalistic things. By the way, to this day, you may not realize it, but many of the Hasidic customs are based on Kabbalistic ideas. You may not have noticed this, but if you ever met a Hasidic fella, and he's wearing one of them long black coats, as many of them do, right? In almost every case, the right side is buttoned over the left. And you say, well, I'm just not a major critic of Hasidic wardrobe design, so I never noticed that, right? But now you're going to notice, and you're going to say, well, Rabbi, why in the world is the right side buttoned over the left side? Right? And I will tell you, because in Kabbalistic teachings, the right side represents chesed, which means mercy, and the left side represents justice. Now, they're both good ideas. Mercy is good and justice is good. Right? We like justice and we like mercy. Right? If you go into a court, what do you want? A merciful judge or a strict justice judge? Now, you can't have a world that's entirely one or the other, but we certainly want God, if he's going to choose which one to put heavier emphasis on, to put emphasis on the mercy. It's like just a Kabbalistic teaching in your buttons right there. Right? And many of the different styles and the long payas that they wear, many of these things come from Kabbalistic ideas and teachings. Right? So they incorporated Kabbalistic ideas into their movement and behaviors. What's interesting about that, of course, is that the people who were not Hasidic, it was almost, to them, it was almost like a new religion. What is this? We haven't done this for like 1,000 years. All of a sudden, you got this new way of being Jewish. In fact, people who opposed them were known as the Misnagdim, the opposers, I guess. So both of my great-grandfathers, well, I have more than two, but two of my great-grandfathers were Hasidic. And at one point, because everyone's got family going through the Holocaust and showing up in America and rediscovering whatever Judaism they can, so my great-uncle had gone to yeshiva in the United States, to a non-Hasidic yeshiva, a standard yeshiva. And he did some questions and research and realized that his grandfather had been Hasidic. Right? So now he felt a little uncomfortable because he's doing all the non-Hasidic customs. Now he realizes his father's father had been Hasidic. So he went to the Rosh Yeshiva of the yeshiva and he said to him, I'm wondering what I should do. I've been doing all the standard customs of the yeshiva world, but I found that my grandpa was Hasidic. Should I do what I've been doing till now, or should I be like my grandfather? So the Rosh Yeshiva said to him, you should be like your grandfather. He didn't do like his grandfather did, and you won't do like your grandfather did. So that was the attitude. It was like, why would you have to do what he did? He didn't follow his own grandfather. Anyway, so what this means, by the way, until this day, is that generally speaking, you'll have a larger affinity for Kabbalistic / mystical types of behaviors and teachings within the Hasidic movement than anywhere else. To this very day, whether it's the Divrei Torah that they talk about, how they study the Torah, they're more of an affinity for that type of stuff in the Hasidic movement. Okay? And you find that to this day. And there's an opposition. There's a sense of the people who are not Hasidic, at least when I was growing up, are a little bit uncomfortable with that stuff. I was like, that's not us. We don't believe in that. In fact, when I was in Ner Israel, so there was a fellow visiting Baltimore. I don't know, remember his name. And the rumor was, oh, this is one of these mystical, miracle-maker rabbis. He'll look at you, he'll read your face, he'll tell you about your future, and he'll, help you and all that. First he reads you and looks at you and tells you all about yourself. And then, he'll help you change things, whatever. So I thought that was curious and interesting. So I called up my personal advisor and I said, what's our approach to this type of stuff? He said, do not go there. And he said, and in all honesty, even if you believed in this guy, let's say you believed it was real, what's the theory here? What's the theory behind what this guy is doing? Right? Let's say this person can actually tell the future and alter it. How is he going to alter it? Notice, God has this all arranged. And he says, oh, this is what God has planned for you. I'm going to tinker a little bit. And how is he going to tinker? First of all, how does he know it's a better outcome for you? Just because you like it, right? What does he have to do? He has to rearrange where your merits go and where your demerits go up in heaven? And God has it arranged a certain way. He's got a better solution than that? What's the idea here? But anyway, my experience was, I didn't go to the guy, but then I waited till the fellas went to him. And I started taking a poll. What do you think? Because one of the things he does, he looks at you and tells you all about you. So my semi-scientific poll came out that exactly 50% of the guys who went were blown away. And the other 50% said, I don't know what he was talking about. So what that tells me is that there was nothing there. Right? So there's an issue that we have, and I'm skipping a little bit. We can get back to some of these issues. And let's take a moment to look at events and personalities. And this is very relevant to what I'm about to continue with. The idea that there are sort of different approaches to mysticism and Judaism is not new. It is old, and it goes as far back as the commentaries called the Rishonim. In fact, I have here Maimonides and Nachmanides as one example. Maimonides is classically known as a super rationalist. Oh, he doesn't want to buy any of that mystical stuff if he doesn't have to. Right? In many of his works. Now, Maimonides wrote many, many works. So you really can get an idea of what he feels about these things. For example, I've described for you right here in the Laws of Idolatry. Maimonides discusses the law of the Torah, the prohibition of doing magic. There's a prohibition in the Torah to do magic. Has anyone here ever done magic? Yeah, to do magic. This is a prohibition, a biblical prohibition of doing magic. So has anyone here ever done? I mean, don't tell me it's prohibited, right? If you've done magic. So now the question is, wait, does that mean there's such a thing as actual magic? I mean, really? So here's Maimonides, and here's what he says. All these matters, necromancy, enchantment, etc., are all matters of falsehood and deceit. And it was with these that the early idolaters made the other Gentiles deviate and follow them. It is not fitting for Jews, who are the wisest of the wise, to use such nonsense, or even to think that they are of any use. Anyone who believes in these or similar things, and privately thinks that they are true and wise, but that we don't practice them because the Torah forbade them, is an idiot and lacks knowledge. This is my mind. He says, it's garbage. There's no such thing as actual magic. But those people who are wise and of a perfect mentality know very clearly that all these things that the Torah forbade are not wise, but are merely stuff and nonsense, which those lacking in knowledge follow, and because of which abandon the ways of truth. Because of this, when warning us against these nonsenses, the Torah said, you shall be perfect with the Lord your God. He says, listen, all this stuff, enchantments, and all the wacky psychics and readings, all garbage, all lies. So why did the Torah prohibit it? Because people believe it. People tend to believe it. They're likely to believe it. And therefore, it can mislead people. You'll go to a reader who will read and then tell you, you need to eat more bacon. Right? You say, oh, I guess I need more bacon in my diet. Right? No. Listen to God. Right? He said, because it's very easy to mislead people with these things. So that's why Torah prohibited it. No such thing. Yes? Right. So clearly, let's clarify. He said, doesn't Maimonides also address mysticism as well? Like I told you before, Judaism as a system does not exist without fundamental ideas in mysticism. Maimonides himself, same man, who wrote a list of 13 essential beliefs in Judaism, said you're not a Jew if you don't believe in the Messiah, the resurrection of the dead, reward and punishment. He doesn't reject fundamental mystical ideas in Judaism. In fact, he was accused at one point of not believing in the resurrection of the dead. When he wrote this book, he describes the Messianic era and does not describe the resurrection of the dead. Right? In fact, he says in there, don't believe that the Messiah has to resurrect the dead. So someone said, you don't believe in the resurrection of the dead. He had to write an entire letter to refute that and say, God forbid, how can you say I don't believe in the resurrection of the dead? It's a fundamental belief of Judaism. All I said was, a person can be the Messiah even though they haven't resurrected the dead yet. That's all I meant. Right? He says, absolutely. So clearly, he believes. Even the most ultra-rationalist in Judaism, once you get past not believing in prophecy or the soul or afterlife, that's not Judaism anymore. Maimonides was fundamentally one of the greatest philosophers of Judaism of all time. It's just that when you get into more of the magic and stuff like that, he says, eh, baloney. Garbage. Nothing there. So much so that the Talmud describes things called shadim, demons. Maimonides says, never existed. It's in your mind. Right? In fact, there's a discussion in the Talmud about a divorce. It talks about when you can have someone as an agent for divorce. So, you know, a man can give his wife a get. What if he assigns someone to give his wife a get? What if you're not sure if he assigns someone? So the Talmud talks about, what if a guy says, I was in a cave, and I heard him tell me, hey, give my wife a get. So he said, the Talmud says it might have been shadim. It might have been those demons. Demons. So some of the rationalist commentaries say it's not. It's when you're in the dark and you're confused and you hear echoes, you think you're hearing voices. There's no such thing as these things. In fact, they go as far as saying, Maimonides says, the Talmud says, that if you put a mezuzah on your door, the Talmud says, if you have put a mezuzah on your door, you merit special protection. Right? Special protection. Right? So what does he say? He says, what do you mean protection? So some people, oh, that's mystical. Maimonides says, you know what it means? You're protected from forgetting that you're a Jew. Every time you walk in the door, you see the mezuzah, you remind yourself, oh, there's a God, I've got to keep the Torah. And that's the protection. It's like, wow, you really don't go for this stuff. Maimonides, wow, you're just like, anytime you can, just whew. But he's not the only opinion, right? Yes.
What's an eye in hara?
Okay, well, hold on. What Maimonides holds about ayin hara, I'm not really sure. I can look into that. But what an ayin hara is, I'll try to see if we have time. I'll address it, okay? It is legitimate. Ayin hara is a legitimate concept in Judaism.
So,
yes?
I'm stuck on that magic part.
Yes.
In Pharaoh's court,
yes,
they perform magic.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't magic because they don't believe in magic.
Right, that's correct. In fact, you'll notice that the first two plagues, they replicate. And when it came to the third plague, they say, Etzba Elohim, this is the finger of God. And the commentaries say, oh, because that one they couldn't fake. they weren't able to do it. Like everything else, they had a system. So when I was in Israel a few weeks ago, someone showed me a magic trick that I really liked. And he did it so well, I kind of knew how he did it, but I even looking close, I didn't see how he did it. But then when I got back to the United States, I got myself the trick. And it involves moving things from a distance, telekinesis. You know, so I brought that to my Seder table, and I said, kids, you know, there were magicians at Pharaoh's court. I said, but maybe I should try out. And I put down my glasses, and I lifted my hands, and my glasses went, woo! I said, ah! And everyone's like, wow! It's a trick. It's just a trick. It's nothing. Right. And you want to know how I was allowed to do that?
Yeah.
Yes, very good. You are right. So the question is, according to Maimonides, if there's no such thing as magic, then what is prohibited is sleight of hand. The answer is to do magic and claim that it's real. That's what's prohibited. Now, obviously, you're allowed to do a trick and say, I've got a trick. It's sleight of hand. I'm going to fool you. That's fine. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein addresses that. The problem is, as Maimonides clarifies, people using magic to fool people and make them into followers is the problem. If you say, I've got a fantastic illusion, illusions are illusions. And if you pay me $10, I'll sell you the illusion. You know? Yeah.
You also dream.
Yes, yes. Listen, what is and is not legitimate in the views of Maimonides, what in his view, in the rationalist view, is still part of Judaism or isn't, is a longer discussion. You should know that in the Talmud, where it discusses dreams, again, this is a full hour class about dreams, it describes how there was a person named Bar-Hedya who was like the chief dream interpreter who all the folks would go to. It was incredible how good he was. And at one point he was getting on a boat and he dropped his book, his interpretation book, and someone quickly ran up to look at it. And there was like one page, and it said, whatever you tell people is what will happen in their dream, what will happen to their dream. And so it was like the more people paid him, the nicer the dream came out, because it was all power of suggestion. So it was like, ah. So again, it needs more discussion. So just quickly, that was Maimonides. Now Nachmanides over here responds and says, now allow me to explain the issue of magic. When God created everything from nothing, He created the higher forces and gave them power over the lower forces below. One of his incredible wonders is that he placed in the higher powers alternative paths and the ability to alter that which occurs below. This is the secret of magical forces. Therefore, it is proper that the Torah prohibit them so the world can be left to its natural normal state which God intended. So Nachmanides, who is just as great a Torah scholar, said, no, there were paths and shortcuts through the mystical world to interact with the physical world, and magic was real. It happens to be prohibited if you can figure out how to do it, right? So again, all the way back, in the times of Maimonides and Nachmanides, it kind of broke down again with Ashkenazic and Sephardic lines to some degree from that time hundreds of years ago, on whether you were more mystical in your Judaism or more rationalist, right? Again, this plays down to our day, but we have to be careful because here's the problem. Regardless of whether we believe, let's say, for example, that magic is real. Obviously, you see that it's prohibited. It doesn't matter, right? The Torah prohibits psychics, every aspect of enchantments, anything that you can think of, which is like superstitious and magical, the Torah prohibits anyway. So regardless of whether you believe it to work or not work, we're not allowed to do it. As Maimonides points out, there's a phrase, Tamim Tiyah Im Hashem Elokecha. You shall be perfect, or trust, perfect trust in the Lord your God. What does that mean? Because any one of these things that you do, you have to ask yourself, why are you doing it? God's in charge. He's got a plan. Do you want to know the plan in advance so you could do something about it? What do you want to do about it? God's got it in hand. What, you don't want God to do what he's going to do? So pray to him, and maybe if you say something, God will change it. Either way, God's got it arranged. What's your theory that you got a better idea than God? What's the concept? What is it that you want to do or know or change? Right? So all of these are prohibited. Trying to contact the dead is prohibited. There's a zillion different things throughout the Torah. The Torah lists all these different things. Lo shenachashu, lo sa'onenu. Don't believe in lucky times. Don't believe in lucky things. Don't believe in lucky events. Nothing. All prohibited. Yes?
So what about segulas?
Great. What about segulas? All right. Now,
are we making the Shabbos?
Okay. I'm more of a traditionalist. I have a very big problem with segulas that have no basis. In other words, if something's in the Talmud or the Mishnah, something has a basis, it has a source, right? The problem with a segula, the word segula sort of means a lucky charm, doing something which brings about good fortune. Now, we, as Jews, have a good number of things which we know for a fact bring about good fortune. They're called praying, good deeds, charity. That's in our religion. That is part of our religious system. Uteshuva, utefila, utzedaka, ma'avir, nesra, ha'gzeri. You say it every Rosh Hashanah. Repentance, prayer, and good deeds, all that's it. We got a fantastic system. So if someone, for example, has something they're dealing with in life, and they say, I'd like to have that changed. So our religion says, great! You can pray, you can do good deeds, you can give charity. These are part of our religion. You say, I'd rather not do that. I'll pay somebody in Israel to pray 40 days at the Kotel and I'll just chill back and change nothing. That is not part of our religion. We don't have these magical things that you can do to avoid God. The problem with segulas is that segulas have become a way to avoid God. A way to evade God. Say, listen, either I can listen to God and start doing things and changing my life and repenting and doing good deeds, or I could do some magical hocus pocus, which is a whole lot easier, and it don't make me feel so bad about myself. Yeah, so segulas are a very big problem nowadays. Shlissel challah itself is complicated because I never heard of it till I was a teenager. That's A. It's very common in some Hasidic movements. It's very questionable what it is, where it came from. It certainly has no source. So what's a shlissel challah? You want to know? Shlissel challah. Baking a key into your challah. You heard of that one?
Yeah.
Good. Now I'm sorry that you heard of it. Okay, now it's all right. If it is not your tradition, do not do it. Let me put it that way. There is a growing interest in doing these things because they feel good, but they have no basis in our religion. And they make us feel like we're doing something to change our fortune. Our religion teaches, if you want your fortune to change, you pray. And it's so simple. It's so straightforward. And if these type of behaviors are going to remind us to do good things, great, do that. Anything which leads us to do better deeds. So, that's fantastic. If we do that instead of doing the good deed, it's the opposite. It's the opposite. So there are many of these types of things that are very questionable. And they become very popular because they're... Do not wear red strings. Yes. Okay, let's ask about that. Changing the parchments in your mezuzah. So listen, if it happens to be that you look in your mezuzahs and some of them are not kosher, then great, change them because you're doing a mitzvah. A mitzvah is a good deed. So you could say, I checked, I found my mezuzahs weren't kosher, so I changed them. But changing a kosher mezuzah for another kosher mezuzah is hocus pocus. Why would you do that? It's like I have a baked potato and I say I'll change it to another baked potato and that'll make me healthy. I don't know. It's the same. It's a baked potato. You know? It's a problem because at one point many of these customs most likely came about as a way for people to remind themselves that they're Jews and remind themselves to do good deeds. Folkways and customs that reminded us what we are and what we're supposed to be, and in some point they became an end in themselves, which is a huge problem because they direct us away from Judaism, and that's the problem. Right? If you believe that, you know, the Shlissel Challah, for example, they say it'll bring you... Rabbi, by the way, if you want to know the history of Shlissel Challah, speak to Rabbi Shlomo Gelbtach. He has researched it in great depth. It's very questionable in and of itself. Yes?
Are a lot of those things from our Eastern European religious.
Yes, they are.
My mother, Mary Sorrows, she did incredible things.
Right.
Yeah,
so, right. So that many of these things, and by the way, that is why you find different locales had different folk ways than others. We all have a mezuzah. That we all have. So we have to be very careful with that. In fact, I remember that Rabbi Weinberg, the Rosh Hashiva of Ner Israel, was once approached about some of this stuff, and they said, well, this fellow, this rabbi, he's known to be a healer. Guaranteed, they're verified miracles of people who were diagnosed with no cure, and he healed them. They went, he prayed, blessed him. So Rabbi Weinberg said, oh, I can do that too. He said, you can do that too, so why don't you do that? I mean, you're letting people get sick. He said, it's very simple. If I get a reputation as a healer, 100 people a day come to me and ask for a blessing. Now, over a year, you do the math, 35,000 people, and the two who get healed out of 35,000, they're the ones you hear about. And two every year adds up. After a decade, you got 20. 20 verified miracles. I can do that too. He was not a big fan. Right? So we have to know what we're dealing with. The problem is we have to separate between mysticism, Kabbalah, and Judaism, at least as far as what is part of our religion and is not. We have 5 minutes left, so I want to cover one or two other important things, and I will allow for questions. If you look down here, C and D, the Arizal was a very important personality. He lived in Tzfas, Safed, in Israel. He's known as sort of the father of modern-day Kabbalah. What's interesting, though, is that he did not write any books or texts that we have among us. Primarily, his teachings are passed along by his student, Rabbi Chaim Vital, and you will see occasionally, throughout Jewish practice, occasionally a mention of an Arizal custom or an Arizal thing, because some of the things that he did in his own way were adopted, whether it's the way you wear your talus, you know, whether the way you there are various things that he did that people adopted as a Kabbalistic approach. Again, he didn't write any books, but he was very influential simply out of his behavior and his students. The Zohar is interesting, because who here has heard of the Zohar? Okay. So the Zohar is what's most widely known as the most famous book of Kabbalah. There are many others. It's famous because it's primarily a commentary on the Torah. It goes by the Torah portion, right? Bereshis and etc. So, like I said before, until you know the Torah, you can't learn Kabbalah. I mean, Madonna decided to skip the whole, you know, Chumash part and went straight to the Zohar. But all right, all right. So, the Zohar is interesting because it is a little bit controversial. I wouldn't say a lot, a little bit. What's controversial about it? It's not that it's controversial that whether it's part of our religion, because it is. What happened was that the book was published somewhere in the 1200s by a man, Rabbi Moshe de Leon in Spain. And the book is generally attributed to the authorship of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who was a Tana sage, a sage of the Talmud. If, in fact, it would be the product of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, that would give it very significant provenance within Judaism. I mean, that's a Tanaitic sage, a Talmud sage, of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Rabbi Moshe de Leon, we don't know who you are, but if you publish a book and you say Thomas Jefferson wrote it, that's pretty impressive. If we say, I wrote it, but I'm pretty sure it's what Thomas Jefferson would say, you maybe sell 3 copies, right? So that's kind of what happened. The problem was, did he or did he not? Who wrote the book? Right? Whether or not it's Torah, it's Torah. Someone wrote a commentary. The question is, who is it ascribed to? So there have been challenges made to the authorship of the Zohar that it may not be Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai who wrote it. And if it isn't, it doesn't have the same impact. Generally, the standard traditional custom is to allow for the possibility that it is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and, you know, follow some of the customs in the Zohar. There are significant questions to that. There are problems in the text that imply later authorship. So that you can either say, okay, those were added later. Maybe some parts of it are Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, some parts are not. But again, it's something to be aware of to know in the context of the Zohar. Okay. I do want to say that if people are interested in Jewish mysticism, understanding some of the basic concepts in Jewish mysticism, and particularly how to address our personal approach today to these type of things, there are a few books I recommend. This happens to be one of them. It's called Faith and Folly by Rabbi Yaakov Hillel, who himself is a prominent Kabbalist. It's not very long. In fact, about that much already is just like the approbations in the front, the first 12 pages of every great rabbi. And he goes through a little bit of the basic background of Kabbalah and some modern-day Kabbalistic practices and holy men and who to go to and who not to go to. And he basically says, don't go to anyone. He basically says, anyone who says they can do X, Y, Z, or etc. is a liar and a fake. And he says, and the greatest proof is if they charge you money. He said, then you absolute, no matter what they say they can do, that is for sure a fraud. Right? So this is a fantastic book, Faith and Folly, originally published in Hebrew. And it was originally published by this rabbi in Israel because of this growth of this industry of, you know, little individual Kabbalist stores, you know, open for readings, and you know, for $100 and special incantations. He said it was all fraudulent, every bit of it. So he was one of the top Kabbalists in the country. He said, don't participate in this whatsoever. So it's an interesting book and worthwhile. I don't know if Beth Jacob has it in the library. Perhaps they do. I would also recommend, if you want something a little more scholarly in the sense of studying in depth the Jewish system of mysticism, the primary book for that would be Derech Hashem. Derech Hashem, The Way of God, written by Rabbi Moshe Chaim Lutzato, often known as the Ramchal by the acronym of his name. Now what's interesting about him is that he published many works, some of them that are not overtly Kabbalistic at all, like Mesilas Yesharim, Path of the Just, and then some which were more Kabbalistic, and he got in a little bit of trouble for it, because what are you doing writing these popular works with Kabbalah in it? But after a while, it was pretty clear, A, that he knew exactly what he was talking about. He was a sage of Kabbalah. And B, you know, it wasn't producing any damage. And in fact, they're classics of Jewish texts today. So the Derech Hashem, The Way of God, is pretty good as well. One last thing I would tell you is that pretty much anything by Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan is very accessible and will almost always have a Kabbalistic dimension. Some more than others. In other words, he translated some actual source texts that you're going to have fun reading, but after 5 minutes, your eyes are going to glaze over. Or you'll just read his books about Jewish rituals and their Kabbalistic underpinnings. Those are not hard to relate to. So those are your three, you know, best sources. There are probably others. Those are your best sources for sort of modern-day Kabbalah. I just want to clarify the last point I was making, which is that unless it is your family tradition, personally, you should always consult a rabbi before you engage in anything mystical, spiritualist, etc. Not only because you may be wasting your time and money, you may be violating a Torah law. So it's important to be aware of that. I mean, it's a funny thing because they seem like harmless things. You know, it's a joke, it's fun. But you may actually be violating a prohibition. So we have to know what we're doing. And anything that's outside of the realm of the 613 commandments and sounds a little bit mystical, check with your local, your rabbi, to see if this is okay. You may save a lot of time and money and heartache, to be perfectly honest. Yes?
What about some people go to a rabbi for a bracha?
So going to a rabbi for a bracha. So a bracha is a blessing. A blessing. So there's nothing wrong. The Talmud says, you know, a blessing by anyone. You should never discount the blessing from anyone. So a blessing is valuable because it's a blessing. So it's a prayer, essentially. A blessing is essentially a prayer. I am praying to God that you shall, things should be good with you. There's nothing wrong with that. And if you believe that someone who's righteous, perhaps their prayers are more powerful, that's a good thing too. So there's nothing wrong with that. It's not really that outside of the concepts of what we do. You know. Yes. Negel Vasser is a commandment. That's a rabbinic pro. Yeah.
What are you doing?
Hold on. I'll get there. So there's two different explanations of why we wash Negel Vasser. Negel Vasser is when we wake up in the morning, we wash our hands. So there's different explanations. One of them is that Yadayim Askonios same. Hands are busy. When you're asleep at night, your hands go everywhere. You wake up in the morning, you never know where your hands went. You're spending the day. You're going to be a righteous person, a holy person. Pray to God. Wash your hands. That's one explanation. The other explanation is you're about to serve God, and as a servant of God, you do an act of ritual to show I'm preparing myself to serve God, like they did in the temple. They'd wash their hands in a symbolic way.
My father
right.
Was also even
yeah.
Take a nap.
Yeah, so that's right. So that was the point. The point is how if you sleep long enough, who knows where your hands went? That's the idea. Yeah.
What is a chamsa?
What is a chamsa? It's a thing that looks like this with the hand.
Right.
Personally, I've never done research. I can't vouch for its validity. I'm not a big fan of anything that looks like that kind of thing. I suspect it may even be from the Arab cultures that we've adopted it. So speak to a rabbi before you get involved with that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. So let me explain a little bit. Again, Chabad is Hasidic, and as I pointed out, the Hasidic movements are more open to Kabbalistic teachings or mystical teachings. The Tanya, the book itself, certainly has Kabbalistic content, but it's more geared probably to an average audience. It probably can be taught to a person. Again, the approach of the Tanya itself was controversial because it was the approach of the Hasidic approach. And then there was a book written from the non-Hasidic approach. But, you know, most of the time, if someone offers a class in Kabbalah, if they are a legitimate Torah teacher, what they're really teaching you is very basic introductory level stuff. And if they claim to be teaching you real stuff like the Kabbalah Center, then they're frauds. I went to Yeshiva with the Kabbalah Center guys. The Kabbalah Center is absolute fraudulent. I mean, sure, they'll translate the Kabbalah, the Zohar for you, and then they'll bless your holy water and fill your pool with Kabbalah water.
Has the Donna written anything on Kabbalah?
Maybe she has. Maybe she's saying things about Kabbalah. I don't know. Yeah.
Lee Ayin Hara, will you tell?
Ayin Hara, Ayin Hara. Okay, Ayin Hara. So like this. What is an Ayin Hara? The Talmud talks about an Ayin Hara. All right, Ayin Hara. What does an Ayin Hara mean? What do the words mean?
Yeah.
Evil eye. Right? So the concept is real. It's in the Talmud. So I believe it's Rabbi Dessler who explains it very simply that here's what's happening, right? How do you get an evil eye? What? That's it? You walk by an evil person, you get an evil eye. Well, describe to me when it is that people are concerned about an evil eye. Like, when you do what? Right, in what case? When you're having a sandwich? Like, when do people ward off evil eyes?
A baby, and you said talking about good fortune.
So, well, anything good happens. So this idea, people like, when is that people are worried about the evil eye is when good stuff is happening, right? You say, what do people do to ward off the evil eye?
Red.
Yeah, I've heard that. Poo, poo, poo. Something red. Okay. Put your thumbs.
There you go, poo, poo.
Knock on wood. Who knows? Okay. So what is the evil eye? Here's how the evil eye works. Ayin hara. Ayin hara simply is, according to Rabbi Dessler, who explained it, he said, the basic concept is, if you have good fortune, and you flaunt it inappropriately, then what's happening is that in heaven, whatever decision was made to allow you this good fortune has to be recalculated. Because initially, there was a decision made to allow you this good fortune. But now, up in heaven, they're noticing that the good fortune that you were allowed is harming someone else. That's unexpected, because you decided to flaunt it. Well, now there's a new calculation here, a little bit more than what was before, and perhaps they'll decide up in heaven to take that away, or minimize, or do something to, you know, make the other person feel better. Maybe you break your leg, and they say, all right, it's okay to have the good fortune, now you have a broken leg. You know, the idea is, it sounds kind of mystical, but basically it's about being sensitive to other people's feelings. So most of the time, for example, you know, in Orthodox society, it's very common that if someone's pregnant, for example, they won't announce it until the pregnancy is obvious, right? Why? Because a baby is a very precious, unbelievable gift. And until you can't avoid telling people, just keep it to yourself. Maybe there's people who can't have children, and maybe there's people who have trouble with their children. So just it's good fortune. Keep it quiet until you're all right. Now it's obvious, you say, right? The idea simply is not shoving your good fortune in people's faces. And, you know, jealousy is the evil eye. The evil eye is someone looks at you and says, is jealous and says, I wish they didn't have that. Why do they deserve that instead of me? So you shouldn't be someone giving evil eye either. Right. But it's not a magical power. It's not something you can wield. What's that? So the red string is very bizarre. It has no legitimate basis in Judaism. In fact, in the Midrash, where there's a list of numerous prohibited practices, one of them is wearing a red thread. It's listed as a thing not to do. So Some people, in justifying it, will say, well, the whole point is that if anyone's looking at you and, like, getting jealous of you, they'll get distracted by that. What's that red thing on the wrist? Like, people have, like, you know, they literally can't concentrate for 4 seconds. Like, whoa, red string. You know. I don't know. You know, perhaps. I don't know what to say. I don't want to stand here and say that hundreds of Jews are violating Torah willfully. People don't know better. There may be some opinions that permit it nowadays. I don't know. I can't see how. But generally speaking, if you ask your average Orthodox rabbi, they will tell you, do not engage in it. Just don't do it. It's a folk practice.
How's that Arab woman on the steps?
That's right. How's she going to make a living selling the red string? Great.
The Ayin Hara is real?
Mm-hmm. Ayin Hara is real. Sure. You make someone jealous from your good fortune, maybe God will decide you don't deserve it. But that doesn't mean that you go poo-poo-poo and this is going to help. Who says that's going to help? Go like this and spit and turn. Why is that going to help? You shove your good fortune in someone's face. Yeah, you say to the Ayin Hara, I guess you try to remind yourself. I mean, if God forbid someone just lost their job and you call them up, you won't believe it, I just want a free cruise, it's going to be great, we're going to have a great time, and come here, I got to tell you all about it and show you the pictures. I mean, at some point, you're rubbing it in their face, you're asking for an Ayin Hara. Yeah. Do not participate in any such things.
These are reputable places.
Isn't the fact that they say that show that they're not reputable? Look, if someone says to you, we'll pray for you, look, praying is praying. What's with the 40 days at the Kotel? There's a wall over here. God can't hear me? And what's with the 40? Is there a source for that? So if someone says, I'll pray for you, so pray for me. You know, there's nothing wrong with praying. But then they get into some of these other stuff. Generally speaking, anyone who does one of those things where it's like, send us a check and then X, Y, Z will do for you. How about the charity? Don't you know? How about I send you a check and the very act of doing the charity will help me. But that doesn't inspire people enough, so they have to come up with something else. Okay, so we're almost out of time. We are out of time. I'm going to just take questions. Feel free to leave. Yes.
In the beginning, you said God is not within us. God blew His essence into us. I know David said something about that. We have an essence.
Right.
So part of us has God.
Right. So the Yifach Ba'ap of Nishmas Chaim is a verse in the Torah. We can't deny that. But we have to understand what that means. God is more inside my body than outside my body?
No, not more.
So what does it mean? Right. We have a divine. We can use the word divine, but to say that God Himself is somewhere here but not there, it's all a matter of terminology. You're right. Of course, the fact that we have the neshama itself, what is it? It's a being from a higher dimension connected to God. We have to understand what that means. No problem. I guarantee you we could be here all night with this topic. We're going to have to end with this question. And if anyone has any interest in this further discussions, Rabbi Freundlich knows how to reach me. The question was kaparos. The question was kaparos, swing the chicken around your head. And if you look at the Shulchan Aruch, Code of Jewish Law, Rabbi Yosef Karo, who wrote the Code of Jewish Law, says, some people have this strange custom about swinging the chickens around their head and they should stop doing it because it's lo sanachashu. It's a violation of Torah law.
Really?
The Ramah, who is from the Ashkenazic country, says, no, this is an ancient custom from the Gaonim, it's perfectly fine. But if you look at the text of the Kaparos, when you're swinging that chicken around your head, right, look what it says there. It says, Zeha Tarnagol Yelech Litzdaka. This chicken will go to charity. Why did people do that? Rabbi Yosef Karo, when he heard of this, he says, that sounds utterly ridiculous. You swing a chicken around your head, now the chicken takes all your sins. It's the nuttiest thing ever. The Ramah understood, I guess because they were more common in his society, he said, what you're doing is, it's the day before Yom Kippur. Poor people need one thing more than anything else. A meal. They need a meal. So you would go out, get a chicken, and you'd say, Zeha Tarnagol Yelish Litzdaka, and there was a custom that everyone would go and donate a chicken to charity, so the poor people would have something to eat the day before Yom Kippur. And you'd say that prayer and you'd give it to charity. Swinging a chicken around your head and chucking it in the backyard is nothing. Totally worthless. What are we, some kind of wacky druids? I mean, what is this? You know, of course not. And nowadays, some people do it with a chicken, some people do it with money. What do you say? You say, Zeha kesef yelch tzedaka. This money will go to charity. What happens if you take the thing, swing it around your head, stick it back in your pocket? Nothing. You wasted your time. All right, everybody. See you another time.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.